Hello and welcome to another episode of Mr. Bolton's English Podcast. We are your one-stop guide to the big literature texts and provide all the information you need to help your children not only pass, but excel in their English GCSEs and other exams and assignments. I am Mr. Bolton and I'm joined each week by a man who is the Toto to my Lone Ranger, the Gargoyle to my Cathedral, Mr. Christopher Visser. Hello, Chris. How the devil are you? Feels like a long time since we actually did a text.
Thanks. A gargoyle, you cheeky s***.
Now, Mr. V, we have to ensure compliance with our good friends at Apple, Spotify, and, you know, make sure we don't go into explicit content for families.
Great. More editing for me to do later.
Always.
Anyway, I'm trying to get in shape, so I'm doing weights on a daily basis now. Plus, I'm still trying to learn bridge. It helps keep me calm and uses key brain cells.
Isn't bridge for the, you know, retired, taking cruises, eating biscuits, that kind of thing?
Kind of, but it's taken a boost in popularity during lockdown. I don't know if you've seen that. Some celebrities have been going on about how great it is, including your favourite presenter, Victoria Corrin Mitchell, who presents quiz show Only Connect. And if she loves it and she plays it, so do I.
That should be on a t-shirt and a mug. And nice to randomly include Victoria Corrin Mitchell in this podcast. And if you're listening, which I'm sure you are, please let us know. And even better, please come on and be a guest.
That would be something, wouldn't it?
It's good to hear your voice, as the last couple of podcasts have featured a lot of me, and not so much as you.
But the listeners have spoken, and now I'm back.
Mm-hmm, something like that. But with the talk with Dr. Pittard on Sherlock Holmes, which was very enjoyable, and this week we're going to go delve back into the world of Arthur Conan Doyle and discuss his novel, Sign of the Four.
That's Sherlock Holmes too, isn't it? With Dr. Watson. Elementary, my dear Watson, and all of that.
Yes, and as said last week, that phrase was never used in the books. Put that in your fact bank, Watson.
But Robert Downey Jr., he was a good Holmes, wasn't he? Though my favourite is Benedict Cumberbatch, as I was saying. I just like saying his name, Benedict Cumberbatch.
He played Stephen Hawking once in a TV show about Stephen Hawking. It was good.
Yeah, he's a good actor, but not as good as, I say, Dean Cain from The Adventures of Lois and Clark, from I remember back in the day, Superman. Or Bradley Cooper or Michael Sheen or...
Are you just saying names to make social media Simon's job harder here?
Daniel Day-Lewis, Darren Day.
Stop it now.
Dame Diana Rigg, okay.
R.I.P. Right, back to what I was saying, or trying to say. Conan Doyle wrote Sign of the Four in 1887, and it's a sequel to the first Holmes adventure, A Study in Scarlet. Neither of these stories were initially successful, and it was only with the publication of the short stories in the Strand magazine that Holmes really took off. Conan Doyle grew to dislike writing about Holmes, as he wanted to be known for his historical fiction.
Like Hilary Mantel?
I guess so.
All right then, Mr. B. What is the sign of the four, and is it something to do with four?
It is. Well deducted. You've been researching your own Holmes.
Detective.
You're something. The story starts with Holmes sat in his armchair at 221B Baker Street, about to inject some cocaine.
What?
It's true. Watson complains to him, "What is it today, Holmes? Morphine or cocaine?" And he points out the needle marks on his arms.
I thought that was added to Sherlock and Elementary to make Holmes seem edgy.
Not at all, no. Holmes takes drugs whenever he has nothing better to do and he can't stand boredom. His mind stagnates. And as Dr. Pittard says, some really interesting things to say about this last week. So if we go over the very quick plot, it starts, as I said, with Holmes taking these drugs because he's got nothing on. Watson has a go at him and he does this really cool thing where he looks at his watch and tells a story, but we'll talk about that later. Next, Miss Mary Morstan comes in and John Watson immediately falls in love. He's like, "Oh, she's beautiful." Oh, doesn't say that, but he's thinking about it. And she's asking Holmes to help find out what happened to her father, who'd been missing for many years. They start investigating this and it leads to the discovery of a missing treasure, the treasure of Agra. And all of that leads to a big climactic boat race on the Thames and the story of Jonathan Small, who had been found this treasure, had been swindled out of it, and had come back for revenge. That's a very quick overview of the plot.
Wow.
But as I said, it's very quick and it's very detailed, but it's a really, I really like it. And there's a few important bits of information here. The novel in Victorian England was becoming more popular as paper and printing was becoming cheaper. Several factors, these are economic factors, such as the growth of the cities, the development of overseas readership. I read something today that the population of England went from 3 million to 20 odd million. In the space of 5-10 years. So it's a real big boom. And the development of overseas readership, authors like Dickens toured America and books were sent out to the colonies.
So could everyone read back then?
Not everyone, but more people than ever. Some studies have suggested that literacy of a very basic level was as high as 96%.
That's really high, but what was popular?
Well, the academic Kate Flint says that fiction was preeminent in terms of readership, especially stories of crime and violence. Stories about people meeting grisly ends and the like are still popular if you think about the detective shows on true crime on TV.
Didn't Dr. Pittard say that Holmes wasn't the first detective in novels?
No, you have a few others, notably Edgar Allan Poe's mysteries. Poe's character, Dupin, first featured in The Murders of Rue Morgue, and he shares a lot of characteristics with Holmes. For example, it can be seen not only foregrounding of the detective's acumen or intelligence, but also in his pairing of a confidential narrator, which in this case is Watson.
But Holmes is very much seen by people as the detective, though, isn't he? They imagine him as the main one.
Yeah, he is. And as Merrick Burroughs said, that Holmes is synonymous with the 19th century detective fiction in general, and he generally eclipses his literary forebears and peers. So everyone that came before him and everyone at the same time are under Holmes's shadow, basically. And would you like a fun fact to take to the fact bank to make a little deposit?
Yes, of course. The fact bank's always open.
Well, Holmes is based on a real-life person, Dr. Joseph Bell, who was a teacher of Conan Doyle's while he was training as a doctor. Dr. Bell's skills of observation were legendary, and he could perform a diagnosis and provide details of a person's life just by quickly looking at them.
You don't know what fun means, do you?
Not according to Mrs. Bolton, at least. Anyway, back to Holmes and the detective novel. Burroughs also states that genre is characterised by a duality, as the narrative is in two distinct stories, that of the crime and that of the investigation.
So?
Well, you have the story of the how and the why of the crime, in this case the death of Bartholomew Sholto and the missing treasure, and then you have the story of Holmes's methods in solving and tracking the criminals down. It's those two strands of narrative propel most detective novels.
Okay.
A few last bits on context. The Victorian era was a time of scientific advancement. Darwin's On the Origins of the Species was first published around about then. Geologists were starting to show how the world was much older than previously thought or described in the Bible. Dinosaurs were being discovered, and all these converged with rising tides of skepticism, outright atheism, and nonconformist believers who rejected the traditional dogmas and institutions of organized religion, which had previously regulated public life.
So people were starting to believe less?
Not everyone, obviously, but I think so. People were, yeah. And this can be seen as Holmes's methods are scientific and logical. He can also be seen to be the ultimate rational person. Lawrence Franks reads these methods as a route into which radical theories depicting the world as godless and driven by chance were made palatable to a middle-class readership.
Okay, but what does that actually mean, though?
Basically, instead of Doyle hitting people over the head with this idea that there isn't a God and that everything just kind of happens, he has Holmes show the working of the world, how one event links to another through cold, emotionless reason and logic.
So how should parents advise their children to include this information?
It's important that it backs up a point rather than feels tacked on. If a student is talking about a character, such as Holmes, an answer will be improved by adding details about the science that was flourishing at the time, how Holmes's rationality was seen as a positive trait, or even how Holmes wasn't the only character working in this manner.
Great. So what about the themes?
Let's go through them one by one, shall we? The first one I've identified is the emptiness of wealth or greed. So the story is centered on a quest for the treasure of Agra. However, the loot is linked with death and misery. The man charged with taking it from the city where it originally was, Agra, is murdered for it. The four men are sent to prison. That's the sign of the four, those four men who decided to rob a person and share the loot individually. Major Sholto steals it from these people, and he spends the rest of his life in fear because of his betrayal and doesn't spend it. He keeps it hidden. Mostyn dies arguing over it, and Jonathan Small's life is ruined trying to recover it. The only people who are happy as a result of the treasure are Watson and Miss Mostyn, as they meet and become engaged because of it. Though Watson worries that if Mary gets the treasure, she'll be too good for him socially and he'll never get to marry her.
So what happens to the treasure, and what would you do with £500,000?
Well, Small actually scatters the treasure over the Thames during the final boat race, and I'd probably have some kind of party, and Sophie Ellis expects the tour tickets. You?
Well, of course I'd be playing bridge with Victoria Corrin Mitchell if I had £500,000.
Do you think you could just rent Victoria Corrin Mitchell out as a kind of like to play bridge with?
Yeah, why not? We've all got dreams.
I don't know if that's legal. But anyway, science and rationality. As I said earlier, Holmes is presented as a modern gentleman who is coldly rational. He doesn't feel emotions like other people because they can cloud his judgment. He's very dismissive about love for that exact reason. He lives to the work and cannot bear boredom. If you look at chapter 1, The Science of Deduction, Holmes coldly reads the story of Watson's alcoholic brother from the scratches on a watch. This, of course, ignores all Watson's feelings. He just coldly says this: he was poor, he sometimes had money, he was a drunk because he scratched the watch. And that highlights Holmes's emotionless search for the truth and the facts that science uses.
They do that in the TV series or something similar in Sherlock, don't they? Where Benedict Cumberbatch analyses Watson's phone.
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing, just modernised, I suppose. It's a demonstration of Holmes's method. He works a case and solves it through the accumulation of little bits of data.
So like CSI London or CSI Bamber Bridge or whatever it is these days.
If you want, yeah. Which leads me on, brilliantly, seamlessly, which is the Gothic and Imperial Gothic. And we could do a whole episode on this.
Could we?
Yeah.
Should we?
Probably.
So, okay, what is the Gothic? Anything to do with kids dressed in black scowling at me as I walk past, listening to Funeral for a Friend? Speaking of which, don't you see them over the white stripes at Leeds Festival one year?
No. I did.
Why? What would make you want to do that? It's insane.
I was a little bit goth.
No, you weren't. You were just moody.
That's true. My massive musical blunders aside, and I still think JJ 72 should have been bigger than they were, the Gothic was a type of literature popular in the Victorian era. It was concerned with nighttime spookiness, the supernatural, mysteries, and creepy locations.
Like horror films, and I agree about JJ 72.
They were really good. Snow was a cracker. And yeah, if you think about the kind of atmosphere that horror films make, it's always in the dark, always have people on their own, foggy moors, all that kind of thing. And it's all about stories of supernatural and the horror.
So what is Imperial Gothic then? It does sound a bit Star Warsy.
It kind of is, but I'm going to go and quote from Patrick Bratlinger, who really should make his name easier to say, who says...
Easy for you to say.
I know. Imperial Gothic, in which adventure stories blend with Gothic elements and Western rationalism, is disrupted by superstitions and the supernatural. So to break that down, in this case, it's the mystery surrounding Tonga and the treasure and the belief that Tonga can't be a real man or that it's a small child. Mm-hmm. And you have Gothic elements such as London and the dark houses and so on, as well as the exotic tales from India, which is seen as dangerous, beautiful, full of mystery. Does that all make sense?
It's fascinating.
Yeah, and if a student mentions Imperial Gothic, that's going to push their answer up a little bit more because it's showing that they have done their own research, they have a better understanding. So, speaking of understanding, or complete and utter lack of, Chris, what do you know about the Indian Mutiny of 1857?
Probably as much as we all know about Donald Trump's tax records.
That's very political, Christopher. But not 100% relevant in this particular context. The Indian Mutiny was caused by overtaxation and the fear that maybe the bindings that put the bullets and the powder were made out of pork fat or cow fat, which would have been completely sacrilegious to the Muslim and the Hindu people in India. And it features heavily in the story, and it's the incident that allows Jonathan Small to hear of the treasure, to get it, and it's what kickstarts the whole narrative. And it also defines how people from other cultures are presented. This is basically the idea of the other. And that is someone who's the outsider, someone who's different, and that is dangerous to your society.
It's a bit like in Lost, where you've got the others. Or in Burnley, I think it's described as t'other.
I don't know about Lost, but definitely about Burnley, it'd be t'other. Well, I'm just going to go and execute t'other. And we're going to have a look at how Tonga is presented as it's, well, problematic. He's described using words that make him sound almost inhuman. He's an unhallowed dwarf, a savage, a cannibal.
Unhallowed. Should a student focus on that word?
Yeah, totally. Should definitely zoom in on that. Because it has connotations about being absent from God or being apart from God. And as churches are hallowed ground. So by implication, the adjective unhallowed is describing Tonga as outside of God's grace. He's totally a savage. He cannot be saved by Jesus or God. And that way you can link in the ideas of rising tides of skepticism and increased atheism. So let's have a look at Tonga's alleged cannibalism as well. Because cannibalism was considered as the ultimate departure from civilization. I say it was, it probably still is. It's Tonga being animalistic and savage. This is something that, since it's so far from the ideals of Western civilization, it needs a Western power to police and to rectify. That is the East India Company or the white man coming in, fixing it, saying, nope, you can't eat people anymore, stop that. And it's in Kipling's famous words, it's the white man's burden to civilize the world. And Tonga is also shorter than the normal man. His stunted physique, you can argue, mirrors his stunted morality. So he's small because he's got low morals. In the Victorian era and in Shakespeare, your outer self mirrored your inner self. So Hyde in Jekyll and Hyde is grotesque because his inside is grotesque, he's evil. And Tonga being shorter means that he's not fully formed. And no one seems to bat an eyelid when Jonathan Small talks about beating him up after he's murdered Sholto.
That's all a bit heavy, isn't it?
Yeah, but it is important.
Okay, so the characters.
Yeah, I'm not going to dive too far into the characters of Holmes and Watson. Dr. Pittard did a really good job explaining it, probably better than I could. But I do have a few quick notes.
How quick?
Very quick.
Go.
So, Holmes. Students need to expand on Holmes as an automaton and unfeeling. He takes drugs to dull reality and needs intellectual stimuli. He is also independently wealthy, but he gets on with other members of different classes, like the Baker Street irregulars or people who he comes in common with. He gets into Sholto's house initially because he fought the prize fighter at the door just for fun before the novel started. And also, he doesn't want the credit for solving the case. The prize is the work.
So what about Watson?
He's a bit of an everyman character, a bit like yourself. He stands in for the reader and relates the detail of the adventures. He is humanising link between the reader and Holmes. We are astounded as he is when Holmes deduces the impossible. And it's that bridge that makes Holmes seem better and also makes it seem believable.
So talking as a curious everyman, who else should students know about?
Well, Jonathan Small is very important. He's a mixture of juxtapositions, if we're going to use a posh term. And juxtaposition is just two contrasting ideas next to each other. So like deafening silence, that kind of idea. Military intelligence. So he is loyal, but he's dangerous. He's honest, but he is a murderer. He is moral in his dealings with the Indians and people, but a cold-blooded killer when necessary. He beats a man to death with his wooden leg, and he doesn't help. In fact, he shoots the guy who originally has the treasure. He is a contradictory character and not a stereotypical type of murderer. He does what he does out of a sense of justice.
So what's Watson's wife called?
Mary Morstan.
So what about her?
Yeah, she's interesting. She's one of the few women in the text, and she's presented as this feminine ideal. She's beautiful, composed, clever, and to Watson, the perfect woman. And that's important as it is Watson talking in the narrative. So she is, to him, an ideal. You may see through her through rose-tinted glasses, her almost rejection of the wealth and her happiness that she's still in the social cast of Watson shows that she isn't monetarily driven. It shows her to place love over wealth and highlights that happiness cannot be bought and everyone who claimed the Agra treasure has suffered for it, which links back to our first theme.
Very good, very good. So, revision, if you're going to study this and be examined on it, what's your tip?
So this week's revision tip is exploding quotes. And this is something that students should be doing in class, but it's really important that they practice. So you get a blank piece of paper, lined or plain, it doesn't matter, and you ask a student to write a quote in the middle of a page. This can be "to be or not to be" from Hamlet, or it can be "my mind stagnates at boredom" from Sign of the Four. They then draw a circle around it and make a mind map. They go through each word and classify it as either a metaphor, simile, verb, and so on. And that is the core assessment objective 2, content. A student explains where this quote is in the novel. So this is from chapter 1. This is from act 4, scene 2, whatever. And that is AO3, context, because that's part of context as well. A student can then develop this by saying what it generally means, why the character is saying it, and whereabouts, what historical information is influencing this text. A student should complete 3 or 4 of these and use the mind map as a plan. And the more a student practices this, the quicker they get. And as a way of doing it, a student can even talk their parents through some of them. Say, "This, look at this quote. This is a verb. This is a noun. This is a whatever. And this explains this. The how, the what, and the where. How does the writer get across an idea? Where is it in the text? And what is it saying?"
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think having parents involved could be very helpful. Obviously, you're talking in the context of the English GCSE here with assessment objectives. You can expand that into any kind of exam across the world, really, just the process there.
Yeah, any exam would have assessment objectives. Or things that an examiner would look for, because otherwise it's just subjective, isn't it? It's one person might like an essay, another person doesn't. So you tailor your exam prep and you tailor your quote explosions to your particular assessment objectives. But as long as you've got things like your metaphors and where it is in the text, you'll be fine.
Excellent. That sounds a very productive revision tip, I think, for students, but also for parents to help with and potentially work through a quote or two with their children.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks very much for that, Mr. B. I think we've gone through that very thoroughly in quite a short amount of time. If anyone has any questions for Mr. Bolton relating to this book or anything that we've discussed in previous weeks, please send in an email. And the address is podcast@mrbolton.com. I think in the next weeks we will start going through some questions and giving some answers with any luck. So please get in touch. You can also find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. Just search for Mr. Bolton's podcast. We're on Twitter. It's Bolton_Mr. Or get us by searching for the Mr. Bolton podcast on Twitter. And we really do love to hear from you. And if you can hit subscribe, give us a rating, a comment, a share, it does help out massively, especially as we try to get in with the algorithms, which are all over the place these days. Those fantastic algorithms. And that will make sure that we're top of more lists, or at least on the list, which would be a good start. So please get in touch.
Yes, and you can hear all our previous episodes, as Chris said, which include stuff on revision techniques with the wonderful Helen Harry, Animal Farm, our interview about unseen poetry and Philip Larkin with Lynn Lockwood, and all of them you can find on your podcast provider or on our website, which is www.mrbolton.com.
MrBolton.com, easy to remember.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, and we will speak to you all next time.
Bye-bye.